welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. This is actually an episode that serendipitously came together through a friend, past guest, Margaret. Hello, Margaret.
Hi, Nick. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for cluing me in on this series, which I know you've written for, Fun City Editions. And it's a series of Blu-ray special editions that have come out. And it's really been remarkable going through its catalog. And it just has its own flavor. And I just really like when an imprint, if that's the right word, can kind of do that. So we're very fortunate to have the man behind the curtain for Fun City Editions. And that is Jonathan Hertzberg. Hello, Jonathan. Welcome.
Hi, Nick. Thank you for having me, and thanks, Margaret, for putting us together. I'm the founder and, I guess, the one-man band behind Fun City Editions, the still pretty young boutique film and music label or imprint. I like imprint, so we'll stick with that.
Okay. And I just to sort of start, I wonder if you could say a bit about how did it start? Was there a particular title or two or three titles where you thought, you know, this needs to be out there and inspired you, or how did it come together?
Well, I've always been a collector. I've been obsessed with film as long as I can remember. And so I've been collecting movies on various formats forever and ever. But prior to launching Fun City, I was working at Kino Lorber, and I was working in theatrical sales and booking. And it got to a point there where I had launched and overseen a sub-label there called Kino Lorber Repertory. So, you know, so my focus was on classic titles, catalog titles. But like I say, I was always interested in publishing and the physical side. But at Kino, they have good people doing all that stuff already. If I was going to do it, I had to do it on my own. Fortuitously, I had some connections with other labels and studios. And so I had launched the Fun City, the business, but I didn't have any titles or anything. And a friend of mine put me together with MGM and Vinegar Syndrome, because Vinegar Syndrome was doing a licensing deal with MGM, and I was invited to sort of piggyback on that deal and license a few titles. So that's how we ended up with the, you know, initial five titles that we have that are from the MGM catalog.
Which five titles are those?
They're in the first six catalog numbers. So we had Alphabet City, we had I Start Counting, Smile, Jeremy, Rancho Deluxe. I think that's everything here. Yeah.
That's a great lineup right there.
Well, thanks.
And actually, coincidentally, I watched I Start Counting. I had no idea it was even in the series, because I had to review a movie, a latest installment of The Railway Children. I'm not sure if you're either of you know about this British like children's series.
Yes.
But Jenny Agutter, obviously, you know, was in that in like the early 70s. This is a new one. So I was very curious to see I Start Counting. I ended up talking about that on another episode I've recorded. But Margaret, yeah.
Alphabet City was really the perfect first release, too, I think, for Fun City. It was so emblematic. Like, it was just a great release.
I guess that's an invite to talk a little about the name Fun City.
Yes.
Which is a nod to the ironic nickname for New York City in the late 60s and 70s, and I guess into the early 80s, when it was at times literally bankrupt. And so, yeah, Alphabet City is, I guess you could say, a Fun City movie. It's set in New York and in the early 80s, and is, you know, documenting just by virtue of when and where it was made, the East Village and that Alphabet City neighborhood just before it really got a facelift, and, you know, before, you know, it got gentrified. So I don't know if I had planned all that when we made Alphabet City number one in the catalog, but I think it worked out well.
I think for a while I had as like my profile the cover of this weird police pamphlet, which is like literally a Grim Reaper face. Am I remembering that?
Yes, yeah. It's Welcome to Fear City pamphlet. Yeah. Fear City was in response to Fun City. Fun City was a nickname that was given to New York. It was sort of throwing back this throwaway quote that Mayor John Lindsay made when the city was in the middle of a transit strike. So everyone was pretty upset because they couldn't take the trains and buses. And the mayor, and he was new at the time, he said, well, I still think it's a fun city. I'm riding my bike around, you know. so they threw Fun City. That's how it became this. The tabloids threw it back in his face. And then it became like this. It became this nickname. And you would see it. You'll see it when sometimes when you watch older films or TV shows, you'll see in the background, like businesses took the name Fun City, you know, so you'll see like a convenience store to a porno theater. You know, Fun City became this. There's a tattoo place. There's a tattoo parlor in the East Village that's been around and still around. It's called Fun City Tattoo. So,
But for me, it was kind of interesting. It was by chance, my connection, initial point of contact was through Morven Callor, which is another title in the series, although I didn't know it when I was working on introducing a screening of Morven Callor, which I guess it's like the 20th anniversary of it this year. And that's directed by Lynn Ramsey. And it's in the Fun City series. And this one is a movie, is one of the movies that you've written about for this series, right, Margaret?
Yes, it is. It's the first one that I, the first booklet essay that I contributed to for Fun City Editions. And I thought it was a really great matchup for my musical interests. I was thinking initially when Jonathan first asked me to contribute the essay, I had my memory of Morven Callor. Pretty soon after it came out, I had seen the film and I had also read the book and really liked it. But my hazy memory of the film was of it being associated in this kind of like club dance scene in Europe, because it was at the time when raves were really big. And I remember her character just sort of wandering through these clubs and kind of disassociating and getting deep into like dance music, which I like, but it's not really my expertise. I have a nickname that's the Prog Lady that I've had for many years because I have a radio show that focuses on prog rock.
Which everyone should listen to.
Thanks. But once I just checked out the soundtrack, I looked at the listing and I was like, no, this is definitely way up my alley. It's a mix. It's like twofold soundtrack where they have access to the Warp Records catalog, which was a type of music that at the time featured bands like Broadcast, Boards of Canada, Aphex Twin. Really cool music. But the other side of the soundtrack is centered around the German band Can, which was one of the major groups of the so-called krautrock movement of the 70s going into the 80s. Really fantastic kind of like beat-driven music that also like really prefigured dance music. So it also makes a lot of sense that it would be featured in these kind of like party scenes, because a lot of dance music sort of evolved out of krautrock and similar musics.
Yeah.
But there's also the line of connection from the soundtrack to the film and the source novel, which was by Alan Warner, the Scottish author, who also happened to write one of the 33 and a third editions of books that each focus on a different record. And he wrote one on the Can album, Tagomago, which I think is my favorite Can album. I'm not sure. But anyway, he also wrote the source novel of Morven Callor, which he dedicated to Holger Zucke, who is the bass player from Can. And there's some Holger Zucke tracks on the soundtrack as well.
Yeah. And the movie, it's kind of an incredible premise. I mean, basically, Samantha Morton plays a woman whose boyfriend has just killed himself. Mm-hmm. And we join her in this kind of state of, you know, shock while she's listening to this mixtape that he has left her behind. And that makes it, I think, all the more engrossing and mesmerizing. And she's a perfect person for this, Samantha Morton, because it's very much kind of like being inside her head. The music, all of this is very immersive. And Jonathan, I think you said that you saw this when it came out, I guess 2002, I want to say.
I saw it at Cinema Village and I loved it back then. And it kind of, over the years, went away. It really hasn't been updated. It hadn't been updated for the HD era. So it was around as kind of an old, really ancient DVD, a really old master, or if you were able to see a rare 35 millimeter screening, it had kind of fallen out of official circulation. And even though it's a more current film, it's a 2002 film, and most of our previous titles had been from like the 60s, 70s, and 80s, I felt like, oh, well, it's coming up actually on its 20th anniversary. And I think that's usually like, that's like one of those arbitrary numbers that people have come up with for like when it's time to bring it back, so to speak. So, and that's what we do at Fun City is bring things back. And I felt like, even though, like I said, it was more current or recent than a lot of our other titles, I felt that it connected with a lot of those 70s anti-heroes, those protagonists that messed around with what the classic notions were for what, you know, a lead character is supposed to do and not do. And this character certainly does that a lot.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, in a way, it's kind of amazing, this casualness that the movie just kind of cruises on with what she does. I mean, I had somehow forgotten that they really have this scene where she's disposing of her boyfriend's body. And then the movie just glides on after that. And I didn't seem to mind that just happened.
And it was, I'm sticking with you, the Velvet Underground song that Mo Tucker sings, you know, so yes. Angelically.
Yeah, it's crazy.
It's got its own brand of humor. And it's certainly present there in that scene.
Yeah, the way that she like passes off the boyfriend's novel as her own, you know, without skipping a beat is kind of humorous in and of itself, too.
Yeah, it really is. And I just want to give a kind of shout out to the cinematographer, who's someone who I think worked with Lynn Ramsey on her previous film, Ratcatcher, which is also a really beautiful film, and a couple of his short films. Alvin Kutler, mm-hmm. You know, who I didn't especially know as a name. I did see it on 35mm. It might have been also at Cinema Village. I've actually come across that lately, that like there were a number of like big films for me I saw there. I remember seeing Goodbye Dragon Inn there as well, probably a couple of years later, because that one took a little bit of time to come out. But yeah, it looks beautiful. It's the sort of movie where you watch it now, and not to get nostalgic, and I'm not putting down digital, but it's feels like one of those like last hurrahs of like a certain peak of 35mm and color, and even the way it moves through images, and especially since so much of this movie is about her like moving through the world.
I mean, there was definitely a hole where, you know, this release was needed. Lynn Ramsey is such a vital filmmaker, and this is really a great film, and there was not a good release of it at all before the Fun City one.
No, and I mean, that was a big thing for us. I mean, a lot of our releases have been premieres on disc, even on Blu-ray at the very least. Not all of them, but a lot of our releases have been Blu-ray premieres or DVD premieres or even home video premieres. Yeah, there had been a DVD, but it was from like the dawn of DVDs. So, and this movie really, as you say, it is sort of the last hurrah of like 35mm filmmaking, that, you know, it is kind of getting towards the point where digital started becoming, you know, much more prevalent in the production and, you know, through the whole workflow. And most of our releases, of course, since we're working on films from earlier than that, we are mostly doing film to digital restorations. So in this case, you know, we worked from the IP, the interpositive, which is one generation removed from the negative. So we couldn't access the negative. So essentially, our disc is even closer to the negative than a release print would be.
That's great. And well, just one quick tiny music thing before we move on to another title. One thing that struck me, there's one track I think they play at the party, which sounds, and I'm just showing my ignorance here, but it sounds so much like a dub like song, you know, like reggae dub.
Oh, I think that's one of the Holger Zuke tracks.
Is that what it is? Okay, yeah.
I think so.
But that was so interesting to me because I kind of, it made me think about what sort of cross-pollination might be going on between like Can and like dub reggae at the time.
For sure.
I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, well, Holger Zuke was technically the bass player too, so he was definitely influenced by all of that. And yeah, that's from his album that came out in 1981, and it's a real gem. It's a real interesting album. It's kind of out of time. You know, it does a lot of interesting experimentations that other people weren't doing.
The tagline, if you will, that I came up with for Fun City, since we don't really focus on a specific genre and it can be a little hard to pin down what we do. The phrase I came up with was movies that exist outside of their time.
Yeah.
And I sort of feel like Morvern, you know, just what we were talking about, just with the soundtrack itself, the way that it was kind of melding things that were contemporary at the time, meshing it with these older tracks.
And I really do see the resonance with past anti-heroes. She just kind of like wants to walk out on her life in a way, you know, and just there are all these different things she could do as a person in her position, or she might be expected to do. And she just zigs when she's supposed to zag and everything. Even with her friend. I mean, that's another thing. Interesting thing is that there's like a friendship at the center of this film with someone who he's kind of more feels more trapped in the city where they are. Or the town where they are.
Yeah, it's a really strong, powerful friendship that still falls apart, you know, and they don't resolve it. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, and that might be one possible segue to actually a pair of other films in the series. And one of them was really a discovery for me and also is so intriguingly out of time and also doing interesting things with the things that we expect to see of a movie in its time somehow. And that's Heartbreakers. When did you first see this movie?
I actually didn't see it that long ago. This was actually a pandemic, like a shutdown pandemic viewing for me. I had had the soundtrack, which is by Tangerine Dream, for years. I had found the soundtrack on vinyl for like $3 years ago. And I remember looking at the back, I was like, Heartbreakers. For some reason, it looked cheesy to me. I don't know. I mean, it's not really fair, but I didn't watch it. And then, you know, cut to pandemic time and a good friend of mine, Chris O'Neill, who's an Irish film programmer and filmmaker who's done some video essays for us on some of our other releases. And actually, he did the commentary track on Heartbreakers. He recommended it to me. He said, this was a formative movie for me, and it seems like something that might be up your alley. And it's never come out on DVD even. It's kind of this forgotten American sort of late era New Hollywood movie, and it sort of has fallen off the map. It was a title that is in the MGM catalog, and we had a relationship already with MGM titles. So it very quickly became one of those movies where I said, this is a perfect kind of fun city movie because it's really just been out of circulation for so long. And yeah. I don't know why, you know, it's just funny. This is one of those movies where I just look at it like, I don't know why that happened. You could see some reasons why, but then it doesn't make sense to me why some movies just continue, you know, to maintain and to stay out there. And a movie like Heartbreakers just doesn't.
Mm. Yeah.
It went out of circulation in the video cassette era.
It is strange that it's not in the flow. It has this milieu that people, you know, go back and watch movies about art world kind of settings. And that's kind of where the two main characters, well, I mean, one of them is an artist. That's Peter Coyote's character who plays Blue.
And he's based on a real artist named Blue.
Right. I saw in the credits.
Robert Blue. Yeah. And it's actually his artwork that Peter Coyote, his character, is painting in the movie.
Yeah. I think when the movie starts out, he's still like working a regular job just to support what he does. I mean, he does
fetish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fetish painting renditions. I don't know.
But they're like photorealistic. Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so his best friend is this guy who's the scion of like this factory owner, just works for his dad. He's none too happy about that. And the bond between them, you know, through all the right, wrong, and crooked of what goes on was really interesting to me.
It's the ultimate bromance. I mean, it really is. It really is the ultimate bromance. And I mean, that's how the film starts and ends. That's the narrative, like, arc is really their friendship. And there is heterosexual romance in it, too. A few of them, actually. But that's not really at the center of the narrative. I don't think it's really about these two guys and their friendship.
Yeah, they sort of like love and hate each other. You know, mm-hmm. They're picking each other up at the same time that they're putting each other down.
There's a real like push and pull, kind of constant tussling going on, but like this loyalty at the same time. And they're both at like pivotal points, I guess, for Blue is trying to get more established or take his work more seriously. And also just the setting. I mean, it's all LA shot.
Yes. Yeah. It's an LA movie through and through.
But it's still very fun city, I think, you know, for LA, like... Mm-hmm. It has a very downtown artist eclectic scene.
That's true, because he lives, Blue's character lives in a loft. Yeah, and a lot of the scenes there are parts of LA that you don't see in the movies that often, I feel like. Mm-hmm. It has a very, that feel of an insider. These are people that actually really know the geography of the city. And in fact, the writer-director, Bobby Roth, is born and raised in LA. And, you know, so he was filming it in a lot of the places and neighborhoods that he grew up in and lived in.
I felt like that must be the case somehow, because, you know, it's details like Fatburger.
Yeah.
That they always go to. But it ends up feeling like this kind of like democratic thing that doesn't happen anymore. You know, they go there. And then at one point when they have some like disagreement and one of them is leaving the restaurant, you see there's like a nun.
That's a Duke's too. There's Fatburger and Duke's. Okay. Yeah. But they're both, they serve similar purposes. Yeah.
Yeah. And the nun apparently is the elusive and reclusive Sue Tissue. From the Suburban Lawns, which is a LA new wave band of that era. And that's awesome. Yeah, she's totally uncredited.
Did you confirm that, Jonathan?
Well, I shared it with like there are these like social media accounts that are obsessed with trying to find Sue Tissue, and there's like someone else doing a documentary on the Suburban Lawns. They might be the same person. Anyway, I showed it to them and they were like, "Oh my God, yeah, it's her." she's totally off the grid, but for the cinephiles will recognize her from Jonathan Demme's Something Wild, because she plays the wife of Jeff Daniels's office mate who's at the reunion and has the line where she says that Jeff Daniels' character is going to get in trouble with Ray Liotta's character.
Oh yeah. That is so funny though. Where is Sue Tissue?
Where is she? Yeah. Yeah. And it actually makes sense that she would be in that scene. One of the things I liked about that movie is that it's like the rare Hollywood movie that shows punk characters and like not like in a cartoonish or villainous way. They're just sort of in the background there at Duke's. And that's because Duke's was kind of a rock and roll kind of hangout spot. The real Duke's was a place where bands would hang out, and you know, if they were coming through town or whatever. So it kind of makes sense that Sue Tissue is in there incognito.
But then there's the twist, that she's also dressed as a nun.
Before we started recording, I was telling Margaret that, I mean, it sounds like a corny word, but even though, I mean, you know, stuff about it that seems, you know, these are two men from another era to a certain extent, there's an integrity to it, you know, like they're kind of soul searching and trying to be direct and open and, you know, just accepting whatever, you know, resentment is bubbling to the surface. And
yeah, there's an integrity and it's very earnest, but also there's this, I don't know how to say this right, but there's like a European flavor to the film too. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of European influences in it. Tangerine Dream being one of them, Michael Bauhaus being the cinematographer, and just I think like Bobby Roth's influences, as like a lot of filmmakers from the 70s and 80s were influenced by European filmmakers, and that seeps into the film too, which at the same time is very American and is very cheesy. I mean, like has some dollops of cheese in it. But then you have like the ending scene. I mean, spoiler, but when Peter Coyote like breaks down crying, it's really moving, and he's crying about their friendship between these two men.
Yeah. No, that's really great. I just feel like I have, how many times do you see that?
Never.
No, you know, at the risk of sounding really corny and cheesy, it is a movie with a heart on its sleeve. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's like something I really love that about a lot of movies from that era, especially from the 70s, where there's this earnest quality crossed with a gritty quality. That's what makes so many of those movies from that new Hollywood era they're so beguiling to me anyway, because I like that there's sort of those two things at once. There's parts of them that, yeah, it seems kind of corny or a little too honest, but then at the same time, it feels earned to me.
Mm. Yeah. And it's also not like tied up in a bow or like people aren't excusing themselves with, I don't know, like a sarcastic aside or something. Things aren't like put in quotes, and that's just so pervasive now that it's almost hard to recognize when that's not happening. Yeah. You know,
totally. Or there's some stupid like internal invisible balance that has to be maintained in more current films, that it's essentially bullshit, you know. Like certain things have to be excused, certain things have to be punished, you know. Like it's just it's arbitrary almost.
It's true. It's true. And there's definitely stuff I would say in this movie and in most of the movies that we've released where, you know, I know that there's going to be stuff that people are going to watch now and they're going to be looking at it through more of a current lens. And there's stuff in these movies you just can't, you know, you can't, you couldn't do now, because you, mm-hmm. you either, you would just alienate the audience, or like you said, it would have to be explained and balanced. And there's things that Peter Coyote's character does in this movie, and you just, obviously you wouldn't have your male lead doing those mm-hmm. kind of things right. anymore. He's messy. He's not yeah. heroic. He's a jerk a lot of the time.
Yeah. Another character is like, well, you're not what I thought you were. What do you think I was? An asshole. You know?
And to the movie's credit, through sort of like accidental casting, good casting, I should say, one of the characters, the character played by Max Gale, who plays sort of the romantic and professional rival of Peter Coyote's character, he was supposed to be like a slicked back, you know, sort of stereotypical jerk. He was the guy who was supposed to be slick. And they ended up with Max Gale. The casting director brought him to Bobby Roth, and he rethought the character. And that guy ends up being, in a lot of ways, the better man and the bigger person than Peter Coyote's character.
Yeah.
Which is a nice sort of, you know, way that the movie goes against the grain.
Yeah. Oh my God, that scene where Peter Coyote comes over to their place and he has what seems to be a genuine conversation with the guy. They share a beer and it's like, okay, yeah, we figured this out. And then he turns on his heel, and in a second, like, his ex walks in and he's like, get back together with me.
Yes, yes, yes.
You're like, yeah. Holy shit.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. So yeah, that's the kind of stuff that people are, you know, a modern audience. Yeah. They look at it like, oh, this guy is such, yeah, he's such an asshole. Like,
yeah. Why would he do that? Yeah.
How can I get into a movie where I can't relate to the lead character? Mm-hmm. You know, I don't like him.
I love that scene also, because I think it's the very moment when they're clinking their beer bottles. That's when the ex walks.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she's like, totally. What's going on? Yeah, it's great. And Peter Coyote, yeah, I really grew fond of his voice in this movie. I just feel like his delivery in this movie is really, which I guess he ends up doing a lot of voiceover. So
that's his whole gig now, is he does the Ken Burns voiceover now. He doesn't do on-camera acting anymore. But we did get him for an interview on our Blu-ray, and he's great. Amazingly, this guy is 81 years old.
Whoa.
We interviewed him when he was 80. I couldn't believe it. Because his memory is so sharp, and he looks amazing. He looks great. I mean, it's all that, you know, Zen Buddhism that he's been practicing for 60 years or whatever. But he has an amazing voice. And he also has a great face, too. And amazingly, he became an actor when he was like 40 years old. And so this was sort of the beginning, very beginning of his acting career. And it happened pretty quickly, because he had been like in the 60s, in the counterculture, he had been one of the founding members of this commune called the Diggers. And this was in California, and then he became involved with like the California Arts Council. So he was doing like a lot of fundraising and politicking. And that's when he's like, I could act, you know, I can do this. And he said he gave himself like 5 years to make it. And he did. And at this time, he's in so many movies. If you look at his filmography, he's in so many like of these sort of odd little independent, they didn't call them independent movies so much back then. He's in a lot of these movies besides, you know, obviously he was in E.T. and things like that. And that's where he became known. But he's in a lot of these little movies. You know, they're very Fun City-esque movies. Some of them may become future Fun City movies. So it's a very interesting career.
And like political documentaries too. And I think he still pops up sometimes on Democracy Now. So he's the real deal.
Oh yeah. Yeah. No, he's definitely, when we had our chat, it went into other directions and yes, definitely got political and he's still very engaged and very committed.
He lived a little before setting foot in front of the camera.
It's
pretty cool. Peter Coyote. Opposite Nick Mancuso, who it's kind of a tough role too. I mean, he has to play this kind of tortured guy he's just clearly adrift. Like his dad dies and he doesn't know what to do next.
He does a great job sort of playing. Bobby told me that he was kind of like also similar to the Max Gale character, not what he had conceived originally. He said originally that character was supposed to be really funny. And that's not Nick. He's actually very earnest and very serious, and he has a palpable sadness.
Yeah.
And it really plays well in that scene, like opposite his father in the hospital. He's trying to connect with his dad, and his dad tells him if he could do it all over again, he wouldn't have children.
Yeah. Well, thanks for sharing. Yeah. Oh, that's great. So yeah, so that's Heartbreakers at 1984. And yeah, the movie that I kind of was connecting it a little with just because of the central romance, although there's other stuff going on in this one. Cutter's Way, Ivan Passer directed, and I guess one of the Czech bomb throwers that were smuggled into American culture, like Miloš Forman, I guess, being the other big one.
Yeah.
What was the kind of connection point for Cutter? I mean, I've seen this movie before. I think I was on a run of, like, you know, 70s kind of hangover hopelessness movies at one point, and this was on that list.
Oh, yeah. Well, this is definitely one of the ultimate post-Vietnam films. And it's also sort of one of the last gasps of 70s filmmaking in the 80s. It's like a 70s movie that kind of escaped out of the industry in the, you know, very early part of the 80s before it kind of became obviously what it became, high concept movies and whatnot. Yeah. And this was like a movie that was in development for years and years. It was like, you know, something that at one point or another Al Pacino was supposed to be in, or Richard Dreyfuss, different directors were attached to it. But it's actually really, just to connect it briefly to Heartbreakers, which, besides the fact that it's a, you know, a movie that's so focused on you know, two male characters that are really tight, Jeff Bridges and John Hurt both were nearly cast or were in the running for Heartbreakers. So
what?
Yeah.
Wait, really?
Yeah. Which, I mean, it's not that surprising because they were talking to every actor of that, you know, generation and that, I guess, that disposition or what have you. So, originally, or at some point, I think John Hurt was even announced at one point as starring in Heartbreakers opposite Michael Ontkean.
What?
So, you know, it's those, yes, boomer guys.
I think John Hurd should have been Blue and Jeff Daniels should have been Eli if I could have cast it.
Oh, wow.
Alternate. Yeah.
I'll ask Bobby if Jeff Daniels is one of the ones that came in, because there were a lot of people. I think they saw a lot of people or talked to a lot of people. Mandy Patinkin was another one that came close.
Wow.
Yeah. So, but anyway, on to Cutter's Way. Cutter's Way.
Well, that's another film that I feel like there was a significant hole in the release.
It was out of print here. So, and I felt like the previous edition, the Twilight Time edition, you know, it had a commentary, an audio commentary track, but it didn't really have a lot of extras. And, I felt like, oh, this is a movie we could do a lot more with. And it was in the MGM catalog, which we've been working with MGM, as I said. So even though it's come out before, I felt like it was, you know, a title that we would be proud to have in our catalog. And I really am.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, just to get the story a little bit, I mean, John Hurd plays the titular Alex Cutter. He's a disgruntled, doesn't even begin to cover it. He's just this sarcastic figure in the movie. He has an eye patch, so he has this perpetual air of being like this not very jolly pirate, but just like saying everything, you know, that you shouldn't say all the time, just getting under everyone's skin. And he's, of course, friends with, you know, the easygoing Jeff Bridges' character. So that's kind of at the center of the movie, and just seeing where that'll spin. But what happens is, you know, almost in the manner of like a detective story or something. I mean, that could be where this movie would go. That's part of what I like. You know, I always like movies that can kind of look like they're going to go one way, but then actually decide to, I don't know, explore the people more and then go another way. So in this case, it's that Jeff Bridges' character sees the disposal of a body one dark and rainy night. And they pull a thread and realize what that might connect back to. And, you know, you have the basic plot of someone in power covering up something they've done. That's the kind of general outlines, but where they go with it is pretty amazing.
I think of it as a sunshine noir, you know, is that type of a film. And it's very political too. And as in a lot of like effective political films, they really home in on the, like the personal ramifications of like an unfair political system. Mm-hmm. And it's devastating. It's absolutely devastating and important film.
I like that you threw out sunshine noir, but it becomes about something much larger than the murder or the ostensible mystery. It becomes a much larger indictment of this kind of rot in the American hierarchy.
Yeah, and the promise that never gets fulfilled. In my mind, it was twinned a little, I realized, I think, I mean, probably just because of Jeff Bridges. I mean, he's also, this is right around the same time, or was it a little earlier? Winter Kills, right?
Winter Kills was right before. Yeah.
In the sense of like a similar, some common points in the mood of.
Yeah.
Mm. I haven't seen Winter Kills, but I'm a huge fan of 8 Million Ways to Die.
Oh, yeah.
That's another like Jeff Bridges, much more unhinged alcoholic performance, but.
Yes.
Primetime Jeff Bridges.
Yeah. It's kind of still an unfairly maligned film. It's a very late era Hal Ashby film. And it was,
I love it. It's messy, but I absolutely love it.
It was taken away from him. So, but yeah, I think I like that film a lot as well. You could do a whole other show on like how it becomes clear when you look at Jeff Bridges' filmography, like how I think carefully chosen the parts are, and that you can see these, like you just mentioned with like Winter Kills. Like I didn't immediately think of Winter Kills, but you can make some guesses, I think, that Jeff Bridges is picking some of these roles because maybe morally, politically, or whatever, he's aligned with them. And then, of course, with Big Lebowski, all of these movies become like proto, all of his characters become proto-dude characters, it seems. Right. You know, which I think part of the reason why that works is because when you look at all of these parts that he played, so many of them are sort of anti-establishment guys. I mean, we did Rancho Deluxe, and I talked to Jeff about it on our interview. I said, you know, this is not something I came up with. In fact, it was several years ago, a friend of ours, Christina Cacioppo, a local New York programmer, she used to program the 92Y Tribeca. And about 10 years ago, she did a series that was called Before the Dude. And it was just all of like, it was Jeff Bridges' retrospective. But it's really true. Yeah, you can see a lot of these characters becoming the dude later on.
Yeah, that was a great 92Y Tribeca and her programmer. I did a series there with Nick Pickerton called Overdue, and we show The Last American Hero.
Love that movie.
Yeah.
I saw it there too.
I love that. Before the dude. I mean, it's just like these different states of like rude awakenings and disillusionment and just seeing them play out, also because he has this just kind of golden boy kind of quality. Mm-hmm. So the surprise always hits home. I mean, there's this particular tone of his voice that he hits in this movie like a number of times.
Oh, yeah. You know,
which I love.
He does it for real too. You talk to the guy and it's like, man, he really is that guy. Like, it's not a put on. And he agreed, by the way, when I said that to him. I was like, hey, what do you think about this before the dude theory? He was like, yeah, man, I like that.
That's great. Yeah, it's all leading up to that. And I mean, John Hurd is also like, you can feel the hurt and the anger that's in there.
Yeah, and he was like, by all accounts, he's no longer with us, sadly. He was a tortured guy in... Mm-hmm. He had issues with addiction, and you know, these things are, and these were, you know, kind of out there. When I watch the film, I it really feels like he's not that he went to Vietnam, but it feels real. Like you really feel the
he suffered, yeah.
But that rage I think that is coming from him. That seething anger that the character has, and also that smartass quality too.
Yeah,
I think that he really had that. That's him. So funny too, you know?
And funny. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, he's smart. He's really, that's the other thing. He's really smart.
Yeah.
That character he's the brains. I mean, Jeff Bridges' character, you know, Bone is the body.
I also thought that, you know, the supporting cast is really interesting as well. I mean, not all actors that I know super, super well, but really just kind of bore these holes of sadness into the movie. But like Mo, the character.
Oh, well, yeah. Lisa Eichorn. I mean, it's a phenomenal performance. And, you know, sadly, she did not have the career I feel like that she should have had. And she had some tough breaks. And we actually interviewed her for the Blu-ray. And we had a great, I went to her house and we had a really wonderful time talking not only about Cutters, but her career and what led to that. I always feel like she kind of gets overshadowed when people talk about Cutter's Way. I mean, we even talked about it. We introduced it as like a male buddy movie. But she really is this key component of that.
Yeah.
It's really, it's a trio. It's, mm-hmm. It's not, you know, it's not just a movie about two guys. She's for both of these guys. She's really driving a lot of what they go out and do.
I felt that she like carves out her own movie with what are shots from their perspectives in a way. You know, like when kind of throwaway scene of like when he's like stumbles upon her in the backyard where she's just hanging out. Mm-hmm. But you managed to, she's able to give you kind of access to this kind of private moment she's having in a way. Or, you know, even a moment of violence when a Cutter slaps her, her performance right after that, I was just riveted in those like few seconds. And I don't know, it was just this perfect, amazing detail of actually getting in her head when she's really literally in the background of that scene at partly, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's a hard character to play because it's kind of long suffering role that could be almost written as like the support system who's there just to kind of reflect how poorly Cutter is. But I think, yeah, she brings it out into this full-fledged character. So yeah, that was great. That's Cutter's way. And I thought maybe we can just have a little cherry on the Sunday of Fun City Things. Just to, also in the lineup is Married to the Mob, which I had to rewatch once I noticed it was on. I think also, Margaret, you told me that this is one you also wrote about the music on, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I don't even, I mean, it's right there in the title. basically, the story is just Michelle Pfeiffer is, you know, married to a mobster and played by Alec Baldwin, which is kind of funny. And what happens when she wants out is basically the whole movie and she tries to start over. But tell me about the music in the movie, because it's really, first of all, there's this thing. Was this just the version I watched on a streamer that the credits like go through a whole bunch of different songs?
No, that's the situation. Yeah, it's an eclectic collection of music, the soundtrack. I mean, there is some incidental music that David Byrne composed that's really good, but it's more about, you know, this curation of tracks that's just so eclectic and wonderful. And yeah, at least half of the tracks that are on the soundtrack album just fly by during that credit scene. That's something else that I found admirable is the not just the soundtrack itself, but the use of the soundtrack. It's not heavy-handed at all. You know, it's this impressive, eclectic, interesting soundtrack, but the music is applied with a light touch. I mean, most of it is diegetic. Almost all of it is just like kind of playing like very quietly in the background on a radio. It's really like the opening and the closing is set to Bizarre Love Triangle by New Order. Mm-hmm. And then there's like one or two other little montages that have, you know, like louder music. But it's more about just the performances, you know, and I feel like that was part just one aspect of Jonathan Demme's talent was really actually capturing the way that he could capture, you know, unexpected moments of performances. So you then what you have is this credit sequence, which goes on for a while, and it's almost like another film. It's like it's not outtakes. It's like alternate versions of the film. And it's chronological, you know, from start to finish. And all of these other songs that are amazing just kind of cycle through it. And I could imagine how Demme maybe even found that preferable than to just like throwing all this music into the film, using it more delicately throughout the film and then giving you like a sort of fun taste at the end of like, you know, buy now on Reprise Records or whatever, you know, the soundtrack.
There's definitely like actors and characters that are only in that end sequence that they didn't have room for in the full film. Like Joe Spinell, for instance, the cult actor, his only scenes are in the end credit sequence.
Oh, wow. And it's funny that the David Byrne music is very appropriate to Michelle Pfeiffer's character because it has this optimistic quality to it.
She's also really sad, though, the whole time, too. Mm-hmm. I feel like it captures that feeling as well.
That's true. Melancholy. Yeah. Yeah. And I can't say enough about Michelle Pfeiffer. I mean, this is no news flash. But, I mean, anytime when I go back and see some movie, you know, Fabulous Baker Boys is something I saw during the pandemic. And it's just really just one of the true like dazzling stars.
Luminescent.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. And interesting here because, you know, she's first of all acting under this like enormous, this big hair, mob wife hair.
And the accent too.
Mm-hmm. And the accent. Yeah. But she kind of makes herself small a lot of times because she's like really starting over, showing insecurities and things. And mm-hmm. It's very disarming. And she starts over, I mean, in New York. So this is another kind of through line. This is Lower East Side, I want to say, like above Delancey, right?
Yeah. I couldn't say the exact streets, but definitely, yeah, Lower East Side. For sure.
Yeah.
And it wasn't fashionable to shoot a movie there.
Yeah. Certainly not to Dean Stockwell's character, who, you know, everyone who goes there, they all say, like, yeah, she lives in this dump.
They had no idea what it would become 30 years later.
That's right. Yeah. But I also, there's also like nice kind of neighborhood detail. Like she starts working across the street at like a hairstylist.
Hello, Gorgeous.
Hello, Gorgeous. Yeah. Which I love. And I forget the actress name.
That's Sister Carol.
Yes.
And she was in Something Wild as well. She was the waitress in the diner, and she gets to sing Wild Thing at the end of the movie.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Yeah. I don't know. For me, that was like, it ended up being like a real like nostalgia trip seeing it again. Like I suddenly became like this 10-year-old watching it again. Because although it's about like a mob story, it's a mob comedy, there's kind of childlike pure heart to it.
Well, it's very much like a throwback to a 30s screwball comedy mm-hmm, mm-hmm. in so many ways, you know.
Especially with the really strong female parts between mm-hmm. the Michelle Pfeiffer character and Mercedes Rule character. I mean, mm-hmm. they really, to me, they ruled a movie. I mean, mm-hmm. I love Dean Stockwell and Matthew Modine in it, but.
Yeah, I mean, well, definitely like a sideshow is like the Matthew Modine, Oliver Platt, like comedy duo going on. They're these FBI surveillance guys. And they have all like these little routines. They're like the total dorks.
Okay. Yeah. With the hands, their version of the high five. Yeah.
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 Well, tell us about, did you do any interviews with this one or anything?
Yeah. We did, actually had a great time. We tried to get Michelle. We tried a few times. It's very hard to get someone of that stature who's still a star and still working like Michelle is. But we did get Matthew Modine, and he gave us a great interview, and he's done a lot of promotion of the Blu-ray too, which is awesome. It's been our best seller, and I think Matthew's been a big part of that. He's got the Stranger Things following.
Okay. Right.
So I think that goes a long way. But we got Matthew, we got Mercedes Rule. And I mean, she's just a delight. I just watched the movie. She probably cracks me up more than anyone in the movie. Mm-hmm. So it was just so much fun to talk to her. And then we got the two writers, Mark Burns and Barry Strugatz. And they gave us a great interview, just kind of going into the whole genesis of the writing process of this movie. And amazingly, just like how the movie is so breezy and just, I mean, it just moves. And the way they wrote this movie, they wrote the screenplay, is the same thing. It was all very fast, they said. Like, but from conception to when the movie got greenlit to film, to being filmed, was like a year and a half or something crazy. I don't know.
Oh, wow.
And also we have the booklet essay, one of which is written by Margaret on the soundtrack. And then we have another booklet essay by Jordan Searles. And we have a new audio commentary as well.
That's great.
So, yeah.
Yeah. And Jordan's great. I've had her on the podcast. And yeah, no, it's funny. I mean, I began to think of like other kind of mob comedies as well, just around the time. And I saw one in the past year that is hilarious, which I had not seen before. Spike of Bensonhurst.
Oh, yeah.
Which has like strong mob element to it. It's very funny. It's also 88, which I didn't realize.
Yeah, people have brought that up to me as well. It's like, you know, Fun City movie.
Yeah, so it's worth it. It's also like, yeah, kind of stuff you couldn't do anymore.
This is a Paul Morrissey film, right?
Really? Yeah, I don't know that one.
It's worth tracking down.
Wait, who is the main actor in that one?
His name is Sasha Mitchell.
Oh, yeah, I don't know that one.
He's a pretty face, but I think you'd have to look him up to see what else he was in.
It's not Little Joe.
No, Little Joe was, I think it was a little too late for Little Joe to say, you know, that role, I think.
I still follow him on social media. He's still around.
Oh, love him. I love him. Yeah, no, he's still on Twitter. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Sasha Mitchell is amazing. Like, I don't, but also the mob boss in the movie is Ernest Borgnine.
Whoa.
I mean, how can you not love that? I mean,
No, it's kind of a fun cast. Sylvia Miles, isn't it?
Of course she is.
Of course she is, yeah. And then, yeah, I mean, I ended up rewatching The Sopranos, like, recently coincided with watching this, which is kind of funny.
I never watched it.
Sopranos?
Yeah, but incidentally, my mother is...
I have to confess, I didn't either.
Yeah, my mother is a mega Sopranos fan, though. And even now, she went back and she's, like, listening to this podcast that's all about The Sopranos. So for her birthday, I got her a cameo from one of the Sopranos people.
Wait, which one? Who?
I forget. Like, I had to look it up to make sure that...
Oh, you know who was on? John Hurd was on The Sopranos.
Oh,
at one
God.
Point.
Really? Yeah. I love John Hurd.
I tell you, it's like I started watching it and I have to just sit down and watch it. My problem is I always feel like if I get into like a show like that and I didn't watch it when it was on, and it's like how many seasons? You know, and then it's like, well, then there's so many less movies you're going to get to watch.
Oh, wait, Johnny Sack. Does that sound right?
Oh. That's terrific.
I got him to do a cameo for my mom.
That's great. He's one of the New York bosses.
They do have the best names, don't they? Yeah. We have to say they did a great job in Married to the Mob coming up with the names, right? Like Frank the Cucumber, right? The sidekick guys, all the underlings have great names too.
Yeah, they're all great. Yeah.
Well, Nick, did you watch? There's also the Norman Mailer mob movie. Tough Guys Don't Dance.
That is just such a bananas.
That's in the mob canon.
Right. Yeah. That's the one.
It's around the same time. Yeah. 87. That one is. Yeah. There's something to be. It's so funny. I actually talked about this with the writers of Married to the Mob, that it's right before there was a huge mob like renaissance. Cause you had Goodfellas coming out like a couple years later, and Miller's Crossing was, you know, 1990 was like, I feel like when they really had like the sort of like highbrow, you know, acclaimed mob movies.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then The Sopranos, you know, a few years after that.
Also funny that like around whatever, 90, 92, you also have like My Blue Heaven, you know, with Steve.
Oh, right. Yes.
But yeah, the one last thing I want to mention on the kind of mob topic is that I was listening to Richard Pryor's stand up, but he has this routine about when he worked at like a mafia run or affiliated club. And he's doing like all the voices of guys just cracking each other up, like, about like a botched hit where they tried to kill a guy with an ice pick or something, and he has this whole laughing, and it's like it's a scene out of Sopranos. Like feels like a primary text for like just mob. He's so dead on. You just feel like just everyone just kind of joking about the most macabre stuff. Seems true if we believe Richard Pryor. So that's Married to the Mob, and this is still only a fraction of the movies. I just want to mention some other titles. There's Radio On is here. Primetime Panic. I was really intrigued by. This is like a 3 TV movie series.
Yes. Yeah. That was a lot of fun to do. And it was a really kind of like a litmus test because we hadn't done any TV movies, and TV movies in a lot of ways are one of the sort of final frontiers, I guess, of sort of underexplored, under-restored of the film and TV stuff, you know, the TV movie, the TV movies are kind of untapped in a lot of ways.
For sure. Yeah. They're also just movies where I would find and then wonder about, but not have a good way to watch it. Natural Enemies is one of those. Like,
yes.
I definitely want to watch that.
Yeah. Yeah. We're very excited to do those. Both of those. Yeah. Natural Enemies was a real labor of love.
Walking the Edge.
Yeah. But I could go on. Collect them all.
Thank you so much for the venue, Nick. This was so much fun.
Oh, I almost forgot. This can be a one phrase answer. What was the last movie you saw, Margaret?
I watched recently. I watched Identikit.
Oh,
you know that one with Elizabeth Taylor.
Oh wow,
it's pretty good. It's based on The Driver's Seat by Muriel Spark.
Oh, I like Muriel Spark.
Yeah, and that's a really good one too. It's a really great like novella that she wrote. I don't know about noirish, but it's a weird one. It's really, and it's directed by an Italian director. It's in Italy, and Vittorio Storaro did the cinematography, which is gorgeous.
Wow, cool.
And it's hard to explain. It's a weird one.
It's okay.
Yes. Two thumbs up.
Two thumbs up for Identikit.
Identikit.
Yeah. Or sometimes also known as The Driver's Seat, because that's the name of the novel.
The Driver's Seat.
All right. What year was that from again?
Late 60s, I think. I forget.
What a fascinating time period for yes. For her.
For Liz. Yeah. Yeah. She goes all out in this one.
Yeah. All right. Where is that one? Where can you see that one?
It's up on Shudder.
Oh, okay. It's on Shudder. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
All right, and Jonathan, what the last thing you saw?
The last thing I saw was a film called Sincerely Charlotte from 1985, starring Isabelle Huppert and directed by her sister Caroline.
Whoa!
Yeah,
whoa.
It's not in the Film Forum series.
Yeah, I was gonna say.
yeah, it's like it's got a little bit of a crime element, but it's basically Ooh. About this this woman who's on the run, played by Isabelle Huppert, who goes hiding with her. Goes into hiding sort of with her former lover, longtime boyfriend who she's been broken up with and who is now, you know, in this domestic bliss with another woman and child. And it sort of turns into like a road movie. And Isabelle gets to sing, which is cool. She's not a singer, but I think that's why she did the movie in part, was because she gets to open the movie with this very like kind of new, it's very new wave. It's very like, it's very 1985. Wow. If you look at the poster art, it sort of sums it up. Really well.
That's great.
Did her sister direct other films too, or do you know?
Yes.
I'm fascinated.
Yeah. She's directed like 10 movies or so. Yeah. So
it's sort of French, more sort of French domestic kind of movies, right? Or
I think so. Yeah. I don't think this movie actually, Sincerely Charlotte, was one that actually did get a US release back then. But yeah, you're right. I think a lot of them are not necessarily exported here. Yeah.
That's so cool. Well, I'm glad I asked.
Nick, what about you? What's the last thing that you saw?
Oh, this is a good one. Dead and Buried.
Oh, so yeah. Good.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Yeah, so sad and gloomy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, I love that movie.
1981, right?
Exactly. Yeah, 1981.
Good year.
Yeah, definitely a good year.
Nice and soundtrack, too. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Who's on the Who's the soundtrack again?
I can't remember, but I like it.
Yeah, I don't know either.
It struck me when I was watching it.
Very kind of sad heart to it. Just, it's like early 80s in the pace of it or the movement of it. Like, because I also watched like late 80s horror movies. This is in the, mm-hmm. Criterion Channel 80s horror series.
Oh, yes, yes.
But it was so interesting just watching the way this movie moves differently, and just whatever that like fulcrum point is in like 86 or something or 85 when things just seem to speed up in some way. Or get like bouncier. I don't know. I'm speaking gross generalities, but this is definitely like very moody and lots of great gruesome special effects.
Yeah, I haven't seen it in a while, but I do kind of remember that it's very much establishes a certain mood. Yeah, and that is something that is that sort of went out as you kind of allude to by the middle to the later 80s.
Yeah, yeah. Well, because the later things I watched were especially energetic in different ways. I had a double bill of Vampire's Kiss and Lair of the White Worm, both great as well.
Love Lair of the White Worm. I saw on that Criterion series because I don't really want to brag or anything, but I'd seen just about all of them. But although a big gaping hole, I had never seen, I finally caught up on Road Games. I had been meaning to see Road Games for years and just kind of always missed it. And I loved it. It was really well directed too. Like,
yeah,
it was great. And I mean, prime Stacey Keach.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Definitely. I feel like that's a slow, kind of a slow burn early 80s movie too.
Mm. Yeah.
All right. We can wrap it up there. Thanks again. And I hope we can do something like this again soon.
Love to. Thanks so much.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with your host, Nicholas Rapold. Please consider signing up at rapold.substack.com. Special thanks to the Minarets for the opening music. Thank you for listening.